Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on forensics when we come back. Well, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper, things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there was no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin or currency. And that's certainly true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power and a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money versus gold. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. And that's because they knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. And that's because they knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that if they were going to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin in order to take away the people's right to property and thus destroy their property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we're going to have to first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home study. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, please call and order my free general law CD package first. That's free, and it's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and best of all, it's free, costs you nothing. Why don't you call now? Remember, the number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, forensics, the study of or the use of science to solve legal problems or to solve the problem of whodunit. We watch the cop shows on television and we see the CSI people go into the laboratory and they'll take a hair or they'll take a bullet or they'll take something and they'll analyze it a little bit and come back and tell you a whole story about it. And in some cases, that can be very valuable. I remember a case down in, I think it was Atlanta, Georgia, where some guy down there was killing, he was kidnapping and killing little children. And he killed about 20 of them. And he was a serial killer, and it was quite a little story. Well, they finally caught the guy, and they convicted him with just a hair or two that they found in the trunk of his car from one of the victims. Now, the reason that we know that was a successful bust and a successful use of forensics is because even though there was only one or two hairs in the guy's trunk, it's pretty incriminating if those two hairs came out of one of the victims, isn't it? It shows that that victim was either in that trunk or something of his that had his hair on it was in that trunk. And what was this guy running around with the hair of some victim who had been killed? What was that doing in his trunk? But the clincher is, since they arrested that guy and put him in prison, there haven't been any more killings of little children. So when the crime wave stopped, we can be pretty sure we got the right guy. O.J. Simpson, you know, was an opportunist type killing. It was a spur-of-the-moment type killing, not a serial modality at all. And if, in fact, O.J. Simpson did it and he got away with it, that's all right, because he only kills people once in a while. This guy was killing people regularly, making a real business out of it. Now, our theory of law has always been, so far as I can remember in our history here in the United States, is that we would rather turn a guilty man free, like O.J. Simpson, or than we would to lock up an innocent man. And this Chicago Tribune article is dated, in case you'd like to get a copy of the article. It's dated October 17th, 2004, Chicago Tribune, Forensics Under the Microscope, and you can get it from truthinjustice.org. It's easy enough, truthinjustice.org/forensics. and that'll give you a 14-page article that I'm reviewing. Now, notice the last time we were talking about fingerprints, and we found that 25% of these fingerprints over here come into question. The Madrid fingerprint fiasco was one of the highest-profile embarrassments in the country, or of the century since, fingerprinting became one of the most trusted forensic tools employed by police to catch everyone from burglars and car thieves to rapists and murderers. Now, in most cases, prints recovered at a crime scene are run through the FBI's massive databank of prints taken from arrests around the country. After the databank spits out a pool of potential matches, then the fingerprint examiners compare each of those with the crime scene print. They look for points of similarity along the circular ridges and lines that make up a fingerprint. So once a match is made, a colleague double-checks the work. Now, that makes all the sense in the world to have somebody do the work and then somebody check the work to make sure that it's accurate. They didn't do that with this lawyer up in Portland. Four guys looked at it, and all four of them said, yep, that's his prints. Come to find out, the Madrid police identified the real criminal so that the lawyer up in Portland was exonerated. Now, the FBI has long claimed that fingerprint identification is infallible. A top FBI fingerprint official has testified to a zero error rate. But even top officials with the leading fingerprint examiners organization acknowledge that more research is needed to bolster the scientific foundation of fingerprinting. The debate is not so much do fingerprints work, but what is the science? That's what Joseph Polsky, the chief operations officer of the International Association for Identification, asks. Another concern, standards for determining how many points of comparison are needed to determine a match varies greatly among police departments across the country. The FBI has no minimum. It says it relies on its analysts' experience and judgment to determine if fingerprints match. Okay, I'm going to underline that. The FBI has no minimum. There's no minimum standards for how many points of comparison that need to be met in order to conclude that we have a match. They say they simply rely on their analysis and the experience of the analyst and his judgment. That's very subjective, boys and girls. Now, those issues are at the heart of the Mayfield case. You see, the FBI said that it found 15 points where the prints matched. Kenneth Moses, the former San Francisco crime scene examiner the judge consulted, testified that he found 16 points. Now, the Spanish police found 8, and they said that wasn't enough to declare a match. Now, initially, the FBI found the print lifted from a plastic bag containing detonator caps near the March 11th train bombings. The print was of sufficient quality to compare and link Mayfield to those attacks. After the FBI acknowledged their error and it was made public, the government contended that the image of the fingerprint that it examined was of no value for identification purposes. Now, that's particularly difficult to understand since the Spanish police used it to identify Dowd and the FBI had used it to identify Mayfield, said Stephen Wax, the federal public defender in Portland who defended Mayfield. Now, one of the three FBI examiners responsible for the Mayfield match acknowledged the blunder. We just did our job and made a mistake, John Massey said in an interview at his Virginia home. That's how I like to think of it. It was an honest mistake. Massey said he knew another examiner who had already declared a match in the Mayfield case, but he said there was no pressure on him to concur. And while the Department of Justice's Inspector General is reviewing the case, Massey said his faith in fingerprint comparisons is still unshaken. I'll preach fingerprints till I die. They're infallible, Massey said. I still consider myself one of the best in the world. Now, this kind of confidence in the face of error has many historical precedents in technical fields. Physicians initially preferred to rely on their instincts, balking at using instruments as simple as blood pressure gauge that could be understood by laypeople. Doctors did not want to yield to the adoption of such instruments until insurance companies demanded quantitative measurements of patients' health, and Theodore Porter, a professor of the history of science at UCLA. The public's trust in the competence of practitioners and the implicit consensus within the field breaks down when skeptical outsiders challenge it, Porter said. Fingerprint examiners have exhibited a similar resistance, saying that their personal experience is proof enough of their reliability. But there is this lingering question. Will the Mayfield case force them to embrace scientific validation? Now remember, fingerprints have been in use for more than 100 years, and there isn't anything scientific about fingerprints. It's totally subjective, and it's based upon the analyst's interpretation or his belief. Now, there are as many as 16 points that we could use to identify or to make a positive identification. The Spanish police in Madrid used 8 points of comparison. The police over here in America used 15 or 16 and got it wrong. Now, what's that tell you? They are a good tool, but they are not infallible. Now, if you're not guilty, if you've been charged with doing something and somebody says, we've got your fingerprints, Well, if you weren't there and you didn't do it, then that fingerprint evidence is a lie. It may be that it was planted there. It may be that it's being lied about. It may be that it's similar, but it's not a match, and it needs to be cross-examined and exposed for the fraud that it is. But all too often, when confronted with this kind of evidence, victims, that is, the defendants, feel that they're hopelessly entrapped, and they might as well plead guilty to get the best possible deal they can, even though they're totally innocent. Fingerprint examiners have exhibited a similar resistance, saying that their personal experience is proof enough of their reliability. Well, isn't that what we were talking about with this fellow in West Virginia? Zane, remember, the forensic expert, the seriologist? Hey, weren't we relying upon his expert opinion and upon all of his experience? Now, though it captured the most attention, Mayfield's brief arrest was only the latest, not the only, just the latest string of cases in which fingerprinting was called into question. So if you're one of those that thought, boy, when the police have your fingerprints or they claim we've got fingerprint evidence, it's time for you to pack it in, give up and quit, 25% of the time they're wrong. And nearly 100% of the time, that same fingerprint evidence will secure a conviction. Now, that tells me that about 25% of those convictions, then, that are secured with fingerprint testimony are incorrect, just like the 30% of rape convictions are bogus. I would guesstimate that on fingerprint testimony and fingerprint evidence, about 25% are bogus. That's unacceptable in my view. The hunt to find who stabbed Alvin Davis to death seemed simple at first. After all, investigators in the working-class Philadelphia suburb of Upper Darby had found bloody fingerprints on a window and a fan leaning against Davis's decomposing body in the autumn of 1997. After 2 days of examination, the examiner, Anthony Papero, said that he had found at least 11 points of similarity between the bloody prints on the fan and those of a friend of Davis's. The friend was Ricky Jackson. To be certain, Papero asked Upper Darby Police Supervisor Vincent Fetchy, or F-I-C-C-H-I, Fitchy, I guess it is, also a fingerprint examiner, to double-check his work, and Fitchy concurred. Defense attorneys rarely challenge fingerprint evidence, but Jackson's lawyer, Michael Malley, dug deeper when he realized the case rested on the fingerprints. There was no confession from Jackson, and there were no eyewitnesses. The hairstylist who lived in Philadelphia, Jackson said that police had shown him the fingerprints and told him they would convict him, maybe even put him on death row. They said, see the fingerprints here, Davis? They're yours. And Jackson said in an interview, I told them there's no way that they could be my fingerprints. I didn't do it. At trial, Papero and two other experts testified how they had matched the bloody fingerprints on the fan to Jackson. Malloy got his own experts, two retired FBI agents who testified the prints did not match. The jury convicted Jackson anyway, and he was sentenced to life in prison. After his conviction, though, Malloy's experts filed a complaint with the International Association for Identification about Papero and the two other experts who testified for the prosecution. The complaint triggered a review of the evidence by the FBI, which concluded that Papero had erred. And 2 days before Christmas 1999, Jackson walked out of a Pennsylvania jail. Authorities have yet to link the prints to anybody else. To this day, Papero denies misreading the prints. I'm not going to lock somebody up just to clear a case, he said, standing in front of the illuminated screen at the police department where he made the comparison. But the most significant challenge to fingerprinting came in 2002 in another Pennsylvania case. It was a drug conspiracy with charges of multiple murders. Presiding over the case was Judge Lewis H. Pollack, a former dean of the Yale Law School, respected by lawyers on both sides of the aisle in Philadelphia. Well, in January of 2002, Pollack issued a stunning decision that there was insufficient scientific basis for examiners to declare fingerprint matches. It was the first time a U.S. trial judge had rejected fingerprint comparison evidence, despite its long history of acceptance. Pollack ruled, fingerprinting lacked the testing, peer review, uniform standards, and known error rates called for under the Supreme Court's new Daubert standard. Right, now tuck that one away in your heart, boys and girls. Fingerprints are not infallible, and they have been thrown out on the basis that they're not scientific. Now, always remember this, that science means knowledge. Knowledge is something that you can take into the laboratory and you can repeat it over and over and over again. It's like baking a cake. If you put the same ingredients into the bowl, stir them the same amount of times, cook it at the same temperature, you're going to get the same product every time. That's why you buy Ho-Ho Ding-Dongs and Twinkies. You get the same product every time, year after year after year. But fingerprints do not come out that way. They're subjective. It depends upon the analyst and his interpretation and the number of points of comparison that he uses to come up with a match. So that ought to tell you, don't accept fingerprint evidence as being infallible, because it isn't. Now, the British expert, Alan Bale, said his officers, if given the same kind of proficiency tests, would fall about laughing. An FBI agent testified that examiners scored well on the Bureau's own proficiency tests, but a London fingerprint consultant who had worked for years for Scotland Yard testified for the defense that the tests were too easy. The prints were too clean, he said, unlike what fingerprint examiners have to deal with at real crime scenes. After hearing both sides, Pollack acknowledged the problems with the FBI's proficiency testing, but the judge said he was convinced that examiners in Britain and the United States generally agreed on the methods for analyzing prints and that the testimony of an FBI fingerprint expert gave him a substantially more rounded picture of the procedure. In the end, the judge, who had called into question one of the bedrock forensic sciences, gave it a reprieve, agreeing that the FBI had never made a mistake. I have found on the record before me that there is no evidence that certified FBI fingerprint examiners present erroneous identification testimony, Pollack wrote, before concluding, in short, I have changed my mind. His ruling seemed to put the issue to rest. Then 2 years later, the FBI wrongly accused Mayfield in the Madrid case. Fighting unproven science in the criminal justice system, juries often decide a person's guilt, but judges have broad discretion over what those jurors can hear, including which forensic experts and what kind of forensic evidence. For decades, most judges screened scientific testimony according to a 1923 federal decision. Fry versus United States said such testimony must be based on principles sufficiently established to have gained general acceptance in the particular field in which it belongs. Well, in 1993, the U.S. Supreme Court created the stricter Daubert standard, which held that trial judges also must ensure that any and all scientific testimony or evidence admitted is not only relevant, but that the evidence is indeed reliable. But the Daubert standard applies only to federal courts and the state court systems that choose to adopt it. Some state courts, including Illinois, continue to use the Fry guidelines. Now, even though judges rarely bar forensic experts from testifying, the director of the Justice Department's research arm argues that the bench is aggressive in its gatekeeper rule. I have a lot more faith in judges, said Sarah Hart, director of the National Institute of Justice. They can even hire their own experts to inform them in this advocacy system. You can get a lot of information on this stuff. But some jurists themselves say that judges are ill-prepared for this part of their job. Haskell Pitluck, he's a retired McHenry County judge and former president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. He described the problem facing many in the justice system. He said, if lawyers could do science, they'd be doctors. He said, noting that he is better versed in forensics than many jurists, and I don't feel qualified to make many of these calls. A national survey of 400 state trial judges published in 2001 found that while nearly all jurists believed their gatekeeping role was appropriate, only 4% had a clear understanding of the key scientific concepts of probability and error rates. Some forensic disciplines certify experts in their fields, but that's no guarantee of quality. Too often, the lawyers do not do their homework enough so they can properly cross-examine these people. They come in and say, I'm an expert, and some lawyers simply roll over. Every new forensic discipline has been met with skepticism. Even DNA was not readily embraced when it was first used in the 1980s. It was used in the 80s to identify suspects because it was largely untested in the courtroom. Now, this underscores a central dilemma of the justice system. How do we distinguish promising forensic methods and their practitioners from junk science and their charlatans? One of the more bizarre crime lab tools has been championed for more than 15 years by a Dutch police officer, Cor Vanderloot. He contended that when pressed upon a flat person's, or a flat surface rather, a person's ear leaves distinct marks that can later be matched through its unique shape, size, and contours. Vanderloot testified in the 1997 murder trial of David Wayne Kuntz in Vancouver, Washington, that he had examined ear prints in over 600 cases abroad. This Dutch officer, according to court documents, said that he thought it was probable that Kuntz had left his ear print when he pressed against a bedroom door to listen before entering to kill the man sleeping inside. When he was asked on the stand how certain he was, he said, I'm 100% certain of that opinion. Now, Michael Grubb, then the manager of the Washington State Patrol Crime Laboratory in Seattle, stopped short of declaring an exact match, but testified at the trial that Kuntz was a likely source. Grubb, now director of the San Diego Crime Lab, said, the Kuntz case is the only ear print case that he had ever worked on. I examined ear prints from 130 other individuals as part of the Kuntz case, Grubb told the Tribune, and none of the other 130 ear prints were even similar, much less a match. Kuntz was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. In this instance, though, the court's checks and balance system worked, and Kuntz's conviction was overturned after an appellate court ruled that the ear print evidence was inadmissible, and it was not reliable enough for such declarations of certainty. Prosecutors later dropped the charges. So distinguishing the forensic fringe from the cutting edge can be very difficult. Keeping a debunked science from re-entering the courts can be even tougher. North Carolina anthropologist Louise Robbins helped send more than a dozen defendants across the country to prison or to death row. She did it with her self-proclaimed power to identify criminals through shoe prints. On occasion, she even said she could use the method to determine a person's height, sex, and race. By the time Robbins died in 1987, appeals courts had overturned many of the cases in which she had testified, and the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, in a rare rebuke of one of its members, concluded her courtroom work was not grounded in science. But in a laboratory at the headquarters of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Ottawa, the effort to determine identity from feet and shoes is getting new life. Sergeant Robert Kennedy, he's a veteran fingerprint analyst, says he can tell who wore a shoe by comparing impressions left on an insole with a person's foot. Kennedy calls it barefoot morphology, and like Robbins, his work has helped prosecutors obtain convictions. Now, I know that there have been questions about this, and Louise Robbins was a real problem. Kennedy said in an interview in his office, but you don't want to just let an area of forensic sciences go by the wayside. It's good evidence. Unlike Robbins, Kennedy has tried to base his work in science, but since the early 1990s, he has been visiting many Army bases and other sites to build a database of footprints that now exceeds more than 10,000 sets. Well, in the 1998 trial of Jeffrey Jones in South Carolina, Kennedy's work proved crucial to sending Jones to death row. Police investigating a double murder believed a boot that had left a bloody impression in the victim's kitchen belonged to the killer. So they matched the impression to a boot, which was found in a house that Jones shared with another man. The other man, James Brown, who admitted his role in the killings. In exchange for a life sentence, Brown testified against Jones. No physical evidence ever linked Jones to the crime, and he did deny involvement. Though the boots were size 9.5 and Jones wore between 11 and 11.5, prosecutors said that he was wearing them when the murders were committed. Well, at the trial, South Carolina crime lab analyst Stephen Derrick, who had never before testified to such a comparison, he said that he examined the boot insole and an impression from one of Jones's feet. Well, Derrick concluded that the only way someone else's foot could have made the impressions on the boot or the insole would be if the person who had precisely the same foot characteristics, such as the shape and the distance between toes. Now, that's pretty specific. Derrick also testified that he had not made a comparison with the feet of Brown, who claimed the size 9.5 boots were too big for him. Kennedy vouched for Derrick's work as well as the field of barefoot morphology, testifying that he talked Derrick through the comparison process. In 2001, the South Carolina Supreme Court reined in such evidence, ruling that there was insufficient science to support it. And the court ordered the state to either try Jones again or set him free. So even with the ruling, prosecutor Dayton Riddle said he would use the insole evidence again when he takes Jones back to trial. Now, that's good science. Despite the fact that it got reversed, Riddle said, I think what happened there is that I was a little bit ahead of the curve. Now, we'll take a look at toxicology, but I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management or staff of this network, or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about forensic science. And what we're discovering here is that forensic science, while it's good, and we see it on the cop shows like CSI, and they tell us that it's infallible. It's good, but it's not infallible. And the science that goes behind it oftentimes is skewered either by bad techniques or by dishonest scientists or dishonest analysts. So you don't have any way of knowing if the results that comes back from the forensic lab, and it works against you. Let's suppose that you're being prosecuted and they come back from the lab and they say that the serum matches. It may not match, and it may be the science or it may be the technician. You know, I discovered an interesting thing. You know, you go to your doctor and he performs tests. You know, he'll take a blood sample. And what we're looking for here in the blood sample, for instance, is, are you on some kind of a drug? Well, the Airplane Owners and Pilots Association puts out a newsletter, a monthly magazine, and they discovered that you can be taking over-the-counter drugs. You know, you could be taking Tylenol, or you could be taking NyQuil, or something like that, and test positive for heroin, cocaine, or marijuana. So you need to be alert, boys and girls, to these facts. Oftentimes you have some sports figure that's accused of taking steroids, or he's taking drugs, or performance enhancers. And no doubt there are many that do that. But in some cases, the fellow is innocent. He's not taking drugs. He's not taking any kind of enhancers. And in fact, he was taking NyQuil or something else over the counter for some temporary malady. And then when he took his blood test, unbeknownst to him, it turns out, hey, wait a minute, you're on some kind of drug here. Now, we can identify most of these drugs, but there are some drugs the molecules of imitate or look like or are very similar to some other type of drug. So you can have a legal drug from the pharmacy that emulates or looks like or feels like or tastes like, or we think it is, one of those illegal drugs. So tuck that one away in your heart. Let's take a look at toxicology. You know, the analysis of alcohol, drugs, and poisons in the body, as well as testing of seized evidence for the presence of narcotics such as cocaine and heroin. 1836, Scottish chemist James Marsh developed a test to detect arsenic after a jury in a murder trial had rejected his testimony about the presence of arsenic in the victim. And then there's fingerprinting. Matching fingerprints through the individual characteristics said to make each person unique. In 1892, the modern system of fingerprint identification begins to take shape with Sir Francis Galton. He was a British anthropologist and cousin of Charles Darwin, who asserts the uniqueness of fingerprints. Let me draw a line under that one. You know, I heard all of my life that these fingerprints were so unique that there were never any two fingerprints that were identical. That's a pretty broad statement. And in order for me to prove that's incorrect, I have to prove a negative, and proving a negative is impossible. I think it would be better served if we were told, well, we have looked at 6 billion people here on planet Earth. 6 billion people all have 10 fingerprints. Now that's 60 billion prints. Now, are we to believe that there has never been a duplicate of those 60 billion prints? Never, not once. You know, even DNA testing, they give you a percent, they give you a probability that you won't find another match like this in a billion cases, or 6 billion cases, whatever it happens to be. That's how remote the chances of this test being wrong are. But in each and every case, when these witnesses get on the witness stand and they're testifying about the forensic evidence that they have against somebody, it likely is going to put them on death row, or it's going to put them in prison for a very long time. I think it's incumbent upon all of us to have it right, don't you? Now, there's another thing here called firearm identification, the process of matching bullets found at crime scenes with bullets fired from a suspect's weapon. In 1912, Victor Balthazard, a professor of forensic medicine, asserts that machine tools used to make gun barrels never leave exactly the same markings. So after studying images of gun barrels and bullets, Balthazard reasoned that every gun barrel leaves a signature set of etched grooves on each bullet that it's fired through it. And you know he's correct. He's correct. But you know, there are some cases where the FBI has come in and said, this bullet is a match. This bullet that killed the victim is a perfect match to come out of the gun over there owned by the defendant. And you know, a 32 or a 45 or a 30-30 or a particular caliber, just take your pick, It's probably pretty likely that it came out of his gun, and 85% of the time the police are correct when they make an arrest. But 15% of the time they're in error, and 9% of the total time, or about half the time in that envelope of 15%, 9 out of 15, which is a little over 50% now, are convicted and they're innocent. And those are the people that we're concerned about. We're concerned about that minority of people that we are railroading, that we are putting on death row, or that we're putting in prison, and wrongly. It's wrongful incarceration. And that's what we here at the law school are concerned about. It's what the Supreme Court was concerned about in Miranda. It's what courts in general are charged with doing. It's to bring justice to the process. We're fully aware that 85% of these people are, in fact, guilty. But, you know, most of us in the legal business are fully aware that 9% of the people that are arrested are, in fact, innocent. And it's that 9% that we're really trying to protect. Now, there's trace evidence. You know, hair and fibers are examined to connect a suspect to a crime scene or to a victim. I mentioned that to you at the beginning of the program today. That a guy down in, a black guy down in Atlanta, Georgia, and he happened to be killing children. They're all black children, but there's about 20 of them. And he was killing one a week. You know, over a period of years, he'd killed 9 or 10, and then he got really uppity, and he went out there, and he was killing about one a week. He'd kidnap these children, and he was a sodomite, and he'd rape them and kill them, and then throw their bodies in the river. Well, when the police finally caught up to this guy, they searched his car, and they found that this guy had two hairs in the trunk of his car. Now, let me ask you this question. Could it be that the police took two hairs out of the victim, and when they came over to this guy that they were pretty sure was the criminal, they planted the two hairs in the trunk of his car, unbeknownst to him, and then lo and behold, they found the two hairs, which of course were a perfect match to the victim, because they had taken the two hairs out of the victim and put it in the trunk of this guy's car. And could it be that they convicted him with this phonied up evidence? Is it ever a possibility that the police will phony up the evidence, that prosecutors are doing this intentionally to win a conviction against somebody that they know may be innocent or is probably innocent? Boys and girls, that goes on every day of the week in what we call the adversarial system. Now, the theory in the adversarial system is this. Two guys are going to come into the courtroom, and we're going to have a battle. I'm going to present witnesses, and you're going to cross-examine my witnesses, or I'm going to cross-examine your witnesses, or both. And you're not going to pull anything on me because I'm not going to let you, and you're not going to, or I'm not going to pull anything on you because you're not going to let me. And in a fair fight, when we get to the end of the process, we'll know that you're guilty, or we'll know that you're innocent. That's a false premise. Oftentimes you get to the end of the process and there's a guilty verdict that comes down and the guy's innocent, or an innocent verdict comes down and the guy is guilty. Things like that happen. Now, we would like to think that there are more guilty people being turned loose than innocent people being locked up, but that's definitely not the case. I think they're getting about 100% of the guilty guys and convicting them. And they're getting a certain number of other people over here that are totally innocent, and they're arresting, trying, convicting, and then jailing those people. And why would we want to do that? Well, that's the stuff of raises. That's the stuff of promotion. So tuck that one away in your heart. Now, I'm not opposed to this forensic evidence, and I mentioned earlier that when they caught this guy and they convicted him, the death stopped. There's no more deaths. No more kidnappings and murders. So from that piece of evidence, we can be pretty certain that the evidence that the police got, that is the forensic evidence, was in fact true, accurate, and correct. I don't deny that you can take hair from one person, analyze it, and come up with mineral deficiencies. That's what we call hair analysis, or that you can take that same hair and you can analyze that and you can make certain determinations from it. You can take the hair out of a deer, a goat, and a moose, and you can look at it and you can tell whether it came out of a goat, a moose, or a deer. You can actually tell that. You can do it scientifically. 50 different people can use the same scientific method in the same laboratory or in 50 different laboratories, whichever you prefer, and they'll all come to the same conclusion each and every time. That's what real science is all about. Now, in 1920, Edmund Lockhart, professor of forensic medicine at France's University of Lyon, published a criminal science volume and espoused the principle that every contact leaves a trace. Every contact leaves a trace. So in an arson investigation, the examination of fire damage to determine a fire's cause, the fire's origin, and whether it was intentionally ignited. Well, in 1962, John A. Kennedy writes the textbook Fire and Arson Investigation, which puts forth some theories that have since been debunked. Odontology, the examination of dental records to determine a person's identity, such as in mass fatalities. Its more controversial application, bite mark comparisons, links suspects to bite wounds on crime victims. In 1968, Dr. Warren Harvey, an odontologist, is the first to identify a suspect's bite marks, which led to the conviction of a murder suspect in Scotland. Well, that's good. And then we're glad that we found this murderer, and we're glad that we got this forensic evidence to do that. And if the scientist that conducted it was honest, and if his methodology was true, accurate, and correct, we can rest assured that his work was competent and complete, and that it caught and brought to justice an otherwise guilty criminal who was going to escape. DNA testing came along, and the comparison of an individual's genetic profile with the genetic profile from evidence found at a crime scene. In 1993, Kerry Mullis wins a Nobel Prize for polymerase chain reaction, a process that greatly reduces the time required and the amount of evidence needed to do DNA testing. And then there's a brain fingerprint process here. Using a headband with sensors, rather. Let me start that one over. If we use a headband with sensors, the technique measures brainwaves, and in theory, these sensors detect when the guilty recognize details of a crime. It's unclear if it is the next great forensic tool or another chapter of junk science. Then there's brain fingerprinting, using a headband with sensors and techniques. In 2001, after Dr. Lawrence Farwell, a neuroscientist, developed brain fingerprinting, it is first presented in court to an Iowa judge who totally disregarded it. The sources were the forensic DNA consulting Bruce Anderson's 1998 University of Arizona doctorate dissertation and the National Library of Medicine, McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science and Technology and Science Fair Projects Encyclopedia Crime Laboratory. Now, this was an article, remember, which was first written, we'll give credit where credit's due here, first written in the Chicago Tribune on October the 17th, 2004. By Flynn McRobert, Steve Mills, and Maurice Posley, Tribune staff reporters. Tribune researcher Judith Marriott contributed to this report. You can get a copy of it from http://truthinjustice.org. truthinjustice.org/forensics-microscope-htm. I thought that was a pretty dynamite article. Now, remember this movie that's called, or the TV series called CSI? Most Americans get their law or their knowledge of law and police practice from the movies or from television. I wouldn't go so far as to say that there's a subliminal message in these television productions which causes us to make confessions to the police and waive our rights and to misunderstand Miranda or forensic science. I don't know that. I'm suspicious, however. I'm suspicious because in almost every case, from my own personal knowledge and experience, most of what I see that goes on the television screen is in fact great drama. And it creates great excitement and it draws audiences and it sells soap. But for practical purposes, what you learn on CSI or on the television is total BS. It just taint soap. That's not the way it works. The police are always put in the best possible light. They're the champions, the heroes, the good guys. And they never make mistakes. Police never make a mistake on the television screen. But boys and girls out here in the real world, 30% of the people locked up in prison for rape are innocent. 25% of the people locked up in prison because of fingerprint evidence that's been used against them are in prison, and that's a false conviction. Boys and girls, there are a lot of people in jail falsely convicted. It's not that fingerprint evidence is bad evidence. It's not that eyewitness evidence or testimony is bad evidence, but it needs to be cross-examined. It needs to be challenged. You would not take the bid from one contractor to remodel your kitchen. You would want two or three bids so that you could get a good idea that, yes, in fact, the real price for this job runs $9,000 to $11,000. You wouldn't take one bid from a contractor. Why would you take the word of one analyst at a crime lab? A guy who may be incompetent, as the first report that we took a look at in this subject, or the science may be false, like lip reading or lip creases or lip, what do they call that? Lip prints, which is just total fallacy. Now, it could well be that the prints left from your lips on a piece of duct tape may actually match somebody. I mean, that could happen. But there isn't any absolute science that guarantees it. There isn't any way you can check it in the laboratory and do it over and over and over again. Or if you can, nobody's ever done that and documented it. It's pure speculation, and people have been convicted by using that. Now, techniques that are unreliable are not science. It's just opinion. And opinion is carefully weeded out of the courtroom drama, but not out of the television drama. They use opinion and hearsay commonly on television. They use facts that are not supported by the evidence, very commonly. They assume facts that are not in evidence, very commonly. And I think that's because the people that write these television dramas are not themselves lawyers, judges, police, or forensic experts. I think that they consult with some of those experts and then use what we call writer's license to write and tell stories that have high drama, are very interesting, exciting, thrilling stories, but are false. They're fiction. They're not true. The world doesn't work that way. Now, on the hit TV shows like CSI and Crossing Jordan, crime-solving forensic science may produce slam-dunk evidence and tidy endings, but out here in real life, forensic science is far less certain. And the underlying principles of the identification forensic sciences have never been rigorously scientifically proven, said Jay Siegel. He's the director of the undergraduate forensic science program at Indiana Purdue University in Indianapolis. Now, boys and girls, we honest to God believe that forensic science is indeed real science. But the experts tell us, no, it isn't real science. And it's not based upon the scientific principles. Well, that's the tragedy of it. And so when you're sitting on a jury next time, think about these facts that come from the Tribune, or think about this story that you heard here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and then make a decision. But make an informed decision. Don't just believe it because somebody told you. Make them prove it. Well, there's that clock again telling us that our time is just about up, so I'm going to have to cut it off right about here and remind you again that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.